We are moving into the seven factors of enlightenment or seven factors of awakening tonight. And so this month, we're going to start it out. But I thought I would take a little time to talk a little bit about the seven factors themselves, because sometimes we can think that the fact that we hear the word seven factors of enlightenment or seven factors of awakening, it sounds like, oh, this is the good stuff. We were in the hindrances for 5 months of drudgery, and now we're into the good stuff. But it actually isn't even like that. We put these two together because the hindrances and the seven factors are almost quintessentially the same thing. It's a shift in the view. It's a shift in our way of thinking, a shift in our relationship with some given moment. And that shift in our relationship can make all the difference in the world on how we relate to whatever's happening. When I used to go to a lot of retreats in my early years of doing retreats, I had this sense that if I got through the hindrances, like it's like when you first get to the retreat, it's all this drudgery, it's 3 days of trying to get out of the mind, and there's a sense that you got to fight these hindrances and get past them. And then once you get past them, then you're coasting in this much deeper concentration into samadhi, and it's so beautiful, and then the retreat's over. And then you go home, you know, and if you're like me, you like to drive fast, so as soon as you get on I-5, it's all gone, because you just can't drive fast on I-5 anymore. So there's that way in which we think the mind can misbelieve that the end result of practice is this deep concentration into stillness, this kind of jhana blissful state that we can get into on retreats. And we can get caught in the confusion that's the end game of practice. Somehow we're going to get still, and then we're going to be okay. Then we can handle whatever's going on. So people come to me all the time, and the first thing they say is, I've lost my practice. I had it, and then I lost it because I'm, you know, frustrated or emotional, or things are not going right, and I'm having all these difficulties, and there's a sense that I've lost my practice. But it's always good to remember that the Buddha practiced in those very peaceful states. And He didn't, that wasn't his way of awakening in those very subtle, fine states. And he practiced in the rough states, great difficulty in staying with it and, you know, just suffering through whatever he had to deal with. And he didn't get awakened in that either. That there was something in the middle of holding these states of mind in a loftier, more balanced way that allowed his mind to open and awaken. And you can see that when you go on longer retreats. You begin to see on longer retreats that the mind, you know, there's this uphill battle when you first get in, and then there's a steadiness, and then it drops off. And you're back on the uphill battle again, and then there's a steadiness, and then it drops off. And then you're back on this uphill battle, and you can begin to see that, wait, this kind of upping and downing and steadiness and out of steadiness and in steadiness and out of steadiness, that must not have anything to do with me. It must be something else that drives that sense of whether or not the mind is steady or not steady. And I think beginning to see the connection between the hindrances and the seven factors of enlightenment is one way to begin to see that it's less about us and more about how the mind is being. So we're going to talk about these seven factors of enlightenment, but I think over the course of the 7 months, we are going to keep referring back to this relationship with the hindrances and the habit mind. Because that habit mind, if we could think about it this way, it's like the pane of a window. You know, we can see through that window and see the trees and the outside beauty and the lushness of the green right now. We can see that, but we can't really touch it. And we don't have access to it. But if you begin to see that there's a film, a veil, there's an obstruction, a cloud that's between you and this scene, then you can see the relationship between the hindrances and the seven factors of enlightenment. Milarepa, he called this the veil of ignorance. And he said that veiled by ignorance, the minds of men, women, and the Buddha appear to be different. Like the Buddha's mind is awakened, and our mind is like not awakened. Yet, in the realm of the essence of mind, they are both one taste. So in the realm of mind, what Milarepa, I keep calling him, pronouncing his name wrong, but Milarepa, what he's saying is, in the realm of mind, our minds are the same as Buddha's mind. There's not this kind of special mind that Buddha has that we don't have. Somehow or another, Buddha's mind could awaken, but our mind cannot. And when you begin to see this ignorance is the veil that separates hindrance from awakening, then you can begin to investigate and get interested in the nature of that ignorance and turn any hindrance moment into a moment of awakening. Anytime you're in any hindrance, it's a moment of awakening. So the seven factors, they start with mindfulness, is mindfulness, investigation, energy, or some people call it effort, rapture, some people call that joy, tranquility, concentration, and equanimity. And there are three kinds of patterns. I guess I want to talk about the three kinds of patterns that you could begin to see the development, I guess, of these seven factors. Or another way you could think of it is three ways you could actually practice with them, depending on what's going on in any given moment. So the first way is the spiral. You could think of mindfulness begins to send us down into a wanting to discern the present moment. What's going on here? Is it skillful? Is it not skillful? And getting connected to not, is this good or bad, or am I right or wrong, but is this moment here, is it skillful? Is it not skillful? And that interest in the skillful, not skillful, is like the investigation begins to climb in there, and you begin to have some energy in wanting to see. There's something about that interest in a moment in time, that spiraling in, actually interested in it. It's what we were talking about last week. It kind of gladdens the mind. It lifts us up, and there's a way in which joy comes out of that investigation. If we begin to look at our behavior as, did I do something wrong or did I do something right? Is this good or is this bad? Then we could get trapped in this kind of not liking ourselves or punishing ourselves or beating up on ourselves because we think we did something wrong. But in the realm of skillful versus unskillful, wise versus unwise, then you can begin to say, well, what is it that makes this so skillful? And this kind of uplift that comes from that is the joy that comes on the heels of it. But in this joy is also tempered by a kind of concentration and peacefulness, this tranquility, this peacefulness, and there you can abide in equanimity to kind of steel yourself and notice what's going on. In any given moment, you could spiral down into it just by turning your attention towards, is this skillful, is this not skillful? Just getting interested in that. That interest alone will begin to start the spiraling down. We start looking at this kind of evenness of mind. And then something about that evenness of mind even brings us to start again, to get even deeper in our discernment. It's almost like every single scenario that you come up with, if you're willing to turn that mindfulness on and ask yourself the nature of that moment, it begins to create this spiraling downward to look into what's going on. It doesn't mean the moment's going to change and all of a sudden you're going to be like, oh, I'm great now. That's the kind of confusion that seems to come around the seven factors of enlightenment. This idea, I think it's because of the word enlightenment or awakening, and we have a tendency to think that's got to be a positive spot. That's got to be something good there. So it says awakening, it says enlightenment, that must be the good part. And if I'm not in that good, that happy, then I must be doing something wrong. But that's not actually what you're looking for. You're looking for the upward energy and the upward desire, the aspiration, the inspiration to want to understand that given moment. And it is in every person I've ever talked to, whenever they have that moment, when they see something difficult, but they can see the clarity of what's going on here. I see what the mind is doing. It's like the Buddha said, I see you, Mara. I know what you're doing here. As soon as that awakened energy happens, there is joy. It doesn't even matter what you see. You could see some habit that you do where you're always criticizing someone. But when you see it and you understand it as unskillful, it brightens up the mind. And all of a sudden, there's all this, oh, I see that. So another way you could think about these these seven factors is what's called the holistic way of practicing with it. Or not holistic, but holographic is what it's really. It's based on this idea that the way these factors work is not so linear. So the minute you turn towards one and begin to look into that, the rest of them all show up. It's thinking of them in this linear way, and let's say that on this end, the start of it, well, I guess for you guys it would be this way, the start of it's here, and peacefulness is way down here after you've gone through about five or about four of those factors. But you could, in any moment, jump in and say, where's peace in this moment? Where could I find that sense of tranquility in this moment? Just look for that. Seek that tranquility. And in that actual seeking of the tranquility in a moment, all the other factors begin to show up at the same time. Mindfulness begins to show up. The interest comes there again. That sense of energy and rapture and all that evenness of mind and concentration shows up just because you decided to look for peace or tranquility in a moment, or looking for energy in a moment, even looking for concentration in a moment. It's not in this holographic way of looking at the seven factors, you're actually turning towards the seven factors at any doorway you could go in just to move the mind towards practice. And in the course of moving the mind towards practice, all the other factors show up like an actual image itself. And then the third way that it's practiced is this pattern of the way it's talked about is you could think of the seven factors as like a balance. What do they call that? A balancing scale. So mindfulness is in the middle, and on one side are the energizing factors, and on the other side are the calming factors. So you could take a look at a given moment and you could say, do I have too much energy in this moment? Do I need to calm some down? Or is there too much calm and not enough energy, and I need to bring something in? A way to think about it is Bhante Buddharakita, this Ugandan monk, said to me one time that if you can tell where you are in your practice, if you're feeling sluggish and slothy, torpy, that kind of energetic feel, whether you're sitting in meditation and you're feeling that sleepiness, or you're kind of going through the day in this kind of fantasized way, in some respects, there's too much concentration and not enough energy. It's a heaviness that begins to descend over our practice, and we don't have enough energy to uplift us. So we get lost and trapped in this kind of focused fantasy. And we can sit, we can sit in a fantasy dream for like hours, just sitting on the couch, mind going into the fantasy. Maybe you guys can, but I can't sit for hours in my little fantasy world. And so that's a sign that the mind can get concentrated, but it doesn't have enough energy, and it's just falling into this heaviness. Where at the same time, if you have too much energy, but you don't have enough calm, the mind can start getting scattered, distracted, going everywhere. So we're trying to see. So ultimately, that a way to think about it is, in the sloth and torpor, you can begin to have the wisdom to see the seven factors of enlightenment and bring the uplift that you need to remove the fog. Or at the same time, in this aversion, which could be full of energy, you could bring some calmness to the mind and help clear some of the fog of that wanting or not wanting energy. So in some respects, that's what it is that you're doing with both of these seven factors and the hindrances. So what Ajahn Chah, he's a forest monk, and I didn't know this because I was in the teacher training, but we are a forest monk type of lineage. Some of you guys might have known that, but I remember sitting at the teacher training and they were going through all these lineages, and I heard about Mahasi Sayadaw, who was Burmese and very rigid into noting, and I'm thinking, I'm in trouble because that's not my practice. And they talked about Utejaniya and all these different Upandita. They talked about all these different teachers and all these lineages all over the place. And I just kept thinking to myself, I don't remember Rodney teaching like that. And then Guy Armstrong gave a talk about the Thai forest tradition, Sumedho, Ajahn Mun, Ajahn Chah, and all of a sudden I could hear Rodney and everything that they were saying. And that's this, there's a way in which the Thai forest tradition is that our practice is in experience. It is in the moment of experience, and that's what we're turning towards. That's why all the teachings you hear kind of from Rodney and me and Tim and a lot of the teachers, there's always this pointing to, it doesn't matter what you know about mindfulness or know about the practice, but how are you experiencing it in this moment? That's where your wisdom comes, and that's where that's how you're going to grow in understanding. So Ajahn Chah said, how does the Dhamma teach the proper way of life? Ask that question. And he says, it shows us how to live. It has many ways of showing it, like with the roots of a tree or just in front of you. It is a teaching not with words. So still the mind, the heart, and learn to watch. You'll find the whole of the Dhamma revealing itself here and now. at what other time or place are you going to look for it? It's sort of that kind of a practice. That's what we're always pointing to, is not the learning of the Dhamma or the can you intellectually understand the Dhamma, but what could I say to inspire you in any given moment to actually begin to turn towards that moment and using the practice right then and there, investigating it right there. So that's what we're going to talk about in this mindfulness, this first factor, turning that way towards, how could we turn the mind towards that? I wanted to back up, I guess, and talk a little bit about how I saw mindfulness or this understanding of the mind when I first came into practice and the distinction of that now. When I first came into practice, I thought that the mind was something that was connected to the brain and this cognizing kind of experience, a cognizing function of the brain. And so whenever I would hear any discussion about mind, that's what I thought we were talking about, that the practice or the teacher was talking about this brain up here and what I need to do to make this brain function at a certain level. I'm not saying that some of you guys don't necessarily think that way, but some of you might. So I want to just see if I can open that up a little bit and have you think. It may not be mind, this mind that the Buddha was talking about, may not have anything to do with your brain at all. It may be that it has to do with something other than your brain and this functioning aspect of the brain. If you stepped outside of the idea that the mind was the brain, then you might could begin to see the mind as being potential, as being just pure potential, capacity, that the mind could be something other than you inside. The mind could pick up and be aware of something even outside of you, thoughts outside of you, understandings that aren't necessarily inside of you. So a way to think about it is, when we see, like you guys are looking, can see out this window and you can see things. And there's two things that are happening here. There's the external, which is what you are seeing, and there is the internal, which is the capacity that you have to see. And both in that external and internal, it's almost quite difficult to tell where the internal and the external, where the internal ends and the external begins, where the external begins and the internal ends. Where is that line where what we see is not me? That's sort of the understanding of what you're working with the mind, this idea that mind could be something more than your brain. It could be something that is both external and internal, and you're learning to access the capacity of both that external and that internal, becoming aware of it, both the impact of conditioning that's external and the conditioning that's internal, and what's going on between the two. A way to think about this is, you could think of the mind as pure stillness. It's just still aware, just aware in any level. And in that stillness is added opinions, judgments, things we see, things we hear, things we feel, thoughts. All of that gets added into that stillness. You could think of that adding stuff as what we call life. It's kind of the noise of life. Some way that we could tap into the stillness in the moment rather than the noise and the added on stuff that we add on to life. And if that were possible, we might could see that we are not the mind. And if we could see that we are not the mind, I am not the mind, then unskillful thoughts, unskillful behaviors are not indicative of you. Maybe your responsibility to see them, but they're not indicative of who you are. That's what mindfulness, I think, Buddha's mindfulness is trying to show us. There's a lot of definitions about mindfulness out there. It's called moment-to-moment awareness of whatever's arising. That's one definition. There's a sense that I gotta pay attention moment-to-moment to see what's arising. I gotta use my mind to pay attention to whatever's arising. The dictionary says it's a state of being mindful. That's not helpful. Or a practice of maintaining a non-judgmental state of heightened awareness. Can you see the doing in that? I gotta do that. So you gotta think, I gotta have a mind, I gotta have a brain that can be mindful. Because if I can't be mindful, then I'm lost. So there's this constant punishment we do to ourselves because I can't make this brain pay attention. I like the Abhidhamma. It says that mindfulness is the act of remembering. And just like the mind, you may not think about it, but it remembers to breathe, or at least send the impulses to cause the lungs and processing to breathe. It remembers to tell the heart to keep pumping. It remembers all these different things that are going on in our bodies. It constantly remembers to do that. We don't remember to do that, but the mind remembers to do that in order for us to stay alive. And so the mind has an inherent, natural faculty to remember. What we are doing is cultivating that act, cultivating that natural capacity that the mind has to remember. When I went on my 3 months, I don't know if I asked you guys this, I don't think so, but that 3 months seemed like forever, but it was such an unbelievable thing. I don't know how people do the 3 months every year. I can barely function, and I only went to one, and I can barely get myself together from that. But Bhante Buddharakita, he was one of my teachers, he asked me, on my very first visit, why did the mind, he told me, he says, Tuer, you have to decide, why did the Buddha, of all the things he could have taught, why did he teach mindfulness? Why did he insist upon that? But I want you guys to hear how the Buddha explained mindfulness. He said it was useful everywhere, for the mind finds refuge in mindfulness, and mindfulness is its protector. Without mindfulness, there can be no exertion or restraint of the mind. That's the way he looked at it. And he was so serious about it. I want to read one, I'm going to run out of time, so I'm going to read one way that he described mindfulness to his monks. It's kind of rough, I'll tell you here. He says, suppose monks that a large crowd of people comes thronging together saying, the beautiful queen, the beautiful queen. And suppose that the beautiful, beautiful queen is highly accomplished at singing and dancing. so that an even greater crowd comes thronging together, saying, the beautiful queen is singing, the beautiful queen is dancing. Then a man or woman comes along, desiring life and shrinking from death, desiring pleasure and abhorring pain. They say to him, her, now look here, person. You must take this bowl filled to the brim with oil and carry it on your head in between the great crowd and the beautiful queen. A person with a raised sword will follow right behind you, and whenever you spill even a drop, whenever you spill even a drop of that oil, right there will your head be cut off. Now, what do you think, monks? Will that man, not paying attention of the bowl of oil, let him get distracted outside? Do you think he's going to let himself get distracted? They were like, no. And then the Buddha said, I have given you this parable to convey a meaning. The meaning is this. The bowl filled to the brim with oil stands for mindfulness, immersed in the body. Thus you should train yourself. You will develop mindfulness, immersed in the body. We will pursue it. Hand it the reins and take it as a basis, giving it grounding, steady it, consolidated, and undertake it well. That is how you should train. That's Buddha's understanding of mindfulness. That's a long ways from the secular mindfulness that we talk about, right? Like, oh, I gotta be mindful. I need to work on my mindfulness. But you don't think that you have somebody behind you with a sword ready to swap your head off if you spill a little bit of oil. So why would he teach it with that degree of urgency, that degree of forcefulness? It's sometimes described by Buddha as being like a person with their hair on fire. You take care of that hair on fire right then and there. There's nothing else more important than putting the fire out in your head. So why would he describe it that way? When we have a kind of secular way of looking at it that kind of poo-poos it, like mindfulness, oh, we get some relaxation. So many people will say when they hear that I'm a Dhamma teacher, they'll be like, oh, yes, I need to work on that mindfulness. I need to be more still. I need to bring that calmness in my life. That is not the Buddha's mindfulness. That is not the mindfulness we're working on here. We are working on a level of mindfulness that's going beyond that. That's so urgent and so quintessential that the Buddha would use this kind of an example to explain to people why they're going to take it serious. But then if you think about what he said, mindfulness is useful everywhere. For the mind finds refuge in mindfulness, and mindfulness is its protector. Without mindfulness, there can be no exertion or restraint of the mind. That's a much softer, kinder, loving thing, this idea that mindfulness protects us. I think he's pointing to this idea that the same way we kind of protect our eyesight, we take care of our eyesight, we put on skin sunscreen to protect our skin. If I see a fire engine going down the street, I see all these people closing their ears off so they don't get this noise pollution. We protect all these sense doors. And the mind, we let it just run rampant, go anywhere. say anything, do anything. And we don't have a sense of care and protection for it. And mindfulness is that sense of care and protection. I like the way Thanissaro Bhikkhu articulates this. Because I think Buddha was pointing to something way more than relaxation and trying to be peaceful and calm. He's pointing to something that has a depth to it that's much deeper than whether or not I'm in a good mood, happy, still, is everything okay? Thanissaro Bhikkhu calls this, he says that mindfulness consists of three qualities. You could think of them as the triple A: appropriate attention, alertness, and ardency. So it's this idea that you are using your attention appropriately. You're paying attention and you're aware of what you're paying attention to, that you're alert, watchful, paying attention. That's it. You're turning the mind towards something that's going to have your mind aware, and you're ardent, you're intent on what you're doing. This is a quote from Thanissaro that I really like, that he explains this. He said, what Buddha discovered was that the way you attend to things is determined by what you see as important. The questions you bring to practice, the problems you want to practice, the problems you want the practice to solve. No act of attention is ever just bare attention. If there were no problems if there were no problems in the life, you could open yourself up to choiceless awareness. And let me read this again. If there were no problems in life, you could open yourself up choicelessly to whatever came along. But the fact is, there is a big problem smack dab in the middle of everything you do: the suffering that comes from acting in ignorance. This idea of ignorance, that life is veiled in that ignorance, and suffering is connected to that ignorance. This is why Buddha doesn't tell you to view each moment with beginner's eyes. He says you've got to keep the issue of suffering and its end always in your mind. So in one way, what you're doing in this seven factors of enlightenment is learning how to train the mind to become aware of the path that you are on and that suffering is close at hand, to see it and be with it anytime and every time. To make it easier, simpler, more connected, more in line with the way he was describing the person who's carrying this bowl of oil on their heads, filled to the brim. What keeps your attention is, what could you keep your attention that would help you stay present, aware of the path, aware of the fact that suffering is close at hand? And it is the body. The body is the only thing that's in the present moment. It's easier for me to see that sitting on this side in the meditation halls. Sitting on this side, I can see you as practitioners. I can see that you, no matter where your minds are going, and I can sort of look at all of you and think, yeah, there's a whole bunch of going minds everywhere, right? Because I've been there and my mind was going all over the place. So I can see that your body is right here. You may be at home, you may be on your vacation, you could be anywhere, but I know, sitting from this side, you are nowhere there. Your body is right here. And that clarity of being, of seeing practitioners over and over and over in front of me in this constant realization that all the bodies are right here doing nothing. This has probably given me the most, I'd say, wake-up call about how important present awareness of the body and mind is. It's not to say that we don't drift off, but it's, do you know that your body is sitting here and the mind is drifting off? Or are you just off there with the mind and you've forgotten that the body is still just sitting here? That kind of awareness, what you're doing. And so Buddha gave us the body, the feeling tones, the dhammas and the mind, the emotions and thoughts, as a guide to begin to see how to pay attention to the bowl of oil that you're carrying on your head. That's how you can pay attention to it. And since your body is always in the present moment, there's never a time when it's not going to be in the present moment. The mind may not, but your body's always going to be there. And since that's always going to happen, you are always 100% capable of turning the mind and training the mind towards these seven factors of enlightenment. Abhante Gunaratana said that mindfulness is mirror thought. It's mirror thought. So it reflects only what is presently happening and exactly the way it is happening. Mindfulness doesn't have any biases. Thought, the hindrances, they are steeped in biases. So when we apply mindfulness to any given moment, by just turning our attention towards the body in that present moment, we can begin to see through some of our biases, some of our the hindrances and the fogs, conditioning that we live with. I used to think that when I would go on a retreat, it was the fact that I was on this retreat that gave me the capacity to see these things. You can see some things on a retreat. You start getting still and you're meditating. And then one day I was laying in bed, can't go to sleep, just laying there like, oh, what? And I begin to count how much time I spent meditating in the sitting and walking, and how much time I spent doing other stuff. The walking in between, the doing your yogi job, the eating, the going on long walks, the sitting doing nothing. And the meditation hours was only about 6, and if I'm really good, it might be 8. But I'm awake and doing stuff 10, 12 hours more. And all of that has nothing to do with sitting and walking meditation. It has to do with the moving about, going about my day, going here, going there, doing my yogi job, doing all these other stuff, all the things that we would think of that we do in our lives, our everyday lives when we're not on retreat. And it dawned on me, it's not the meditation time. It's the in-between times. It's all the rest of the stuff that I don't pay attention to. I pay attention when I'm sitting, but then the rest of the time, I'm kind of just lost. And then every time I go back to sit, I got to restart the clock again. So even though we're urban practitioners and it may seem like I don't have time to do all that retreat stuff, what I'm trying to help you see is that Buddha's mindfulness is applicable no matter what you're doing, in whatever moment you're at. It's just in the experience, are you willing to turn away from the hindrance, which is usually driving our experience? Can I get what I want? can I get rid of what I don't want? I'm too worried about what's going to happen, or I'm just kind of like checked out, or I'm nervous. I don't know what to do. I mean, there's all this confusion of doubt. Instead of just being in that hindrance from one moment to the next, could we turn mindfulness towards it? Could you use the seven factors of enlightenment to bring enough uplift to want to practice a little deeper, see something else that could be going on in that moment? Could you look and see, is the mind really not the brain? And if it's not the brain, then what is it? Could you look for that and get interested enough to want to see it? I want to leave you with a story and a poem, why it's important to do this. So one time, this monastic friend of mine, Vimala, and I, he was going to, we were in North Carolina at Venerable Panawati's place. And about a couple of miles away from her place, you can go to this hot dog restaurant that is like, that's all they serve is hot dogs. And it is like a production. And people know exactly what they want in the hot dogs. And so before the retreat started, Vimala and I went to this hot dog place, and those were the best hot dogs ever. And I love hot dogs. So of course, I'm on a 10-day retreat, and all I'm thinking about is that hot dog. When I get out of that retreat, I'm going down there and get a hot dog. And I sent Vimala a note, when we get out of this retreat, we're going to get a hot dog. It's like, oh my God, Tori. So as soon as the retreat ends, it's Sunday. We both are not going to leave until later on that night. I said, let's walk down. Let's skip lunch. Let's walk down and get our hot dogs. He goes, of course we are. So we walk down to get our hot dogs, get to the place, and it's closed. Not open on Sundays. And I was so disappointed. I could feel it. I mean, I wanted to cry because it was like I had thought about this for so long, I couldn't wait. And I had blew it. I should have went snuck out on Saturday and got the hot dogs if I had known. That's what I would have did. I was so disappointed. So Vimala, he practices with everything and anything. Everything and anything. He has great wisdom. I get so impressed with him. And we got to trudge up a hill. It's downhill going to the hot dog place. It's uphill going back. I'm so miserable. And he goes, Tori, this is our opportunity to practice with disappointment. I'm like, I don't want to practice with disappointment. I'm like mad right now. I can't even think about that. He goes, this is our opportunity. You should take it seriously. This is our opportunity. I'm practicing with disappointment. I said, I do not want to practice Vimala with disappointment. I just want to get back and pretend like this did not happen. But every time I get disappointed, every time, guess what I think about? I should have practiced with disappointment, because disappointment is going to come in our lives. And we don't ever want it to come, but if something should happen where we have disappointment there, that is your moment. You got to practice with disappointment right then and there. Because if you don't, and you somehow fix the scenario so you're away from it, right? We finally got home. We've thought of something else to talk. He finally agreed to talk to me about something other than disappointment. And we moved on. And I left that disappointment behind. But I assure you, I have experienced that disappointment on more than one occasion since then. But every time I think, oh, I don't want to practice with disappointment. I don't want to practice with it. But you can see that when you actually start practicing with disappointment, then you get used to it. Then you know it. Then you get comfortable with it. And you're like, oh, this is disappointment. It's not the end of the world. I mean, it was, but I really wanted to cry, but I was a little embarrassed to cry in front of him over a hot dog. So let me end with this poem by Albert Hofstetler. I think he says what I'm trying to say, and what I think Buddha's pointing to if we start dealing with dealing with mindfulness and take it seriously, not as a afterthought. He says, we think we get over things. We don't get over things. Okay, say we get over the measles, but not a broken heart. We need to make that distinction. The things that become part of our experience never become less part of our experience. How can I say it? The way to get over a life is to die. Short of that, you move with it. You let the pain be pain, not in the hope that it will vanish, but in the faith that it will fit in, find its place in the shape of things, and be then not any less pain, but true to form. Because anything natural has an inherent shape and will flow towards it. And life is as natural as a leaf. That's what we're looking for. Not the end of a thing, but the shape of it. Wisdom is seeing the shape of your life without obliterating or getting over a single instance of it. So let's sit for a couple of minutes here. Thank you for your kind attention. Probably should stop saying a couple of minutes. I mean a couple of seconds. let's see if there's any questions or if anybody has any comments about this notion of mindfulness. We have a little time before it's time to end. Yeah.
Yeah, I really liked what you said about kind of drawing a comparison between mindfulness of protecting your mind and how, let's just say, society in general doesn't acknowledge the importance of that in our society, the way we protect things like eyesight and hearing and.
That's right.
Skin or other. I think that really gets at why the Buddha emphasized it so strongly like that. It makes so much sense.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so for those of you that couldn't hear, the comment is that he really liked the analogy of mindfulness being protection for the mind, the way we protect the eyes and the other sense doors, and we have this sense of protecting them, but the society doesn't really encourage us to protect the mind or think of the mind as even needing protection the way we protect all the other sense doors. But it does need protection. It needs to be protected even from its its waywardness and its going off on tangents. I think when we start getting that sense of needing to actually care after and protect the mind, instead of grumbling about the way the mind is, it changes the nature of the way we relate to this idea of a mind being something much more vast. I think if we could see how intricate and precious the mind is as an experience, then we could begin to see, oh, I know why we want to protect the mind. Instead of, it's almost, here's a way we could think about it even closer. You could imagine protecting the mind of a young child. There's no question we wouldn't want to shield that mind and protect that mind from a lot of the adult crap that goes on. But it's almost like now that we've become adults, we don't think that we need to protect and shield the mind in the same way. But it's still quite delicate and still quite quite subtle. So protecting it is what gives it that sense of malleability to be able to adjust and be with things. I just think it's remarkable that the Buddha talks about it in this loving way, and then talks about it in this really, like, seriously, I'm not playing, people. I mean it. You want to come in this? He doesn't really play or mix words about it. You know, just the word ardent. We don't even think of ardent, but in the Four Foundations, it's like you sit independent, mindful, ardent, right there, not moving. And that sense of ardency, independent, persistent, staying there, that's the way he treated mindfulness, even though he talked about it in this kind, more gentle way. Yeah. Yeah. How do you do it now? Oh, it's the question is, if I go back to the hot dog scenario, how would I work with that disappointment with mindfulness now? Disappointment rides in this mind. It's the mind let loose. It's sort of the what the Buddha is talking about, that unrestrained mind. It's undisciplined. It's run amok. So it's just going to complain and whine and fuss about this thing that's a problem, and it wants to fix it. It wants the hot dog. But what the Buddha was saying with mindfulness is the body is in reality. This is what Vimala was trying to point to. In reality, the day was beautiful. We had so much fun walking down. We could have easily had fun walking up, right? There's a sense of us being together. The retreat's over. We can talk to each other and hang out, and we don't have a lot of time together. That my mind can get stuck in the disappointment of something it has no control over, and it's a done deal. It doesn't, but when we're caught in that disappointment, then we don't want to begin to question, what is this disappointment here? Is this skillful? Am I like blowing off this great moment in time because I'm stuck in not in something I didn't know? If I had known, we wouldn't have went on Saturday. That's what working with the disappointment means. Because disappointment's going to come, and as soon as it comes, we all know the mind gets caught in the disappointment. It's very hard to actually learn to turn towards, oh, really, I'm in a moment here. The body is right here. The mind is caught in something that is doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense. Let me say it like this. It doesn't make any sense that I got disappointed just because I didn't know that walking all the way down there, the store was closed. When we get back, you know what Venerable Panawati said? You should have told me you were going. I would have told you it's closed on Sunday. You see? Because I didn't know it was closed, that is why the mind was angry, disappointed, right? But in reality, it was closed when I started walking. I just didn't know that. So all of that disappointment, all the playing that we did and the laughing and joking all the way down, it took me halfway up before I let go of that and stopped grumbling and actually started laughing again. But all that time I had to suffer because of something I didn't know and I had no control over. So the idea is working with disappointment or any unpleasantness or pleasantness or neutral is about seeing if you can distinguish between the reality of now, where the body's at, where your sense doors are at, and the mind's discussion about it. And you can begin to see that the mind's sort of caught in its hindrance is not really real. It's just an overlay on top of it. Yeah, you're welcome. Maybe one more if there is one. If not, we're good. We need some announcements anyway. So hopefully I didn't scare the living daylights out of you about the whole oil thing, but I got a feeling sometimes that if Buddha were sitting here, he wouldn't be talking and teaching the way we think of teachers talking. I think he was a little bit rougher. He might be a little bit more like Rodney. It's like we might be thinking, oh, you're just like Rodney. Come on up, Deb.